Big welcome. Thank you all very much for coming. I think I've just heard that this is actually the first talk that's been given in this brand new theatre, which was opened yesterday by the Duchess of Kent. So, Eve, you are an honoured first-timer, which is great. It gives me, I should say, I'm Hugo Slim from the Centre of Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict at Oxford. It gives me really great pleasure to welcome the ICRC to Oxford, and particularly the Director General, Yves Dacour, to Oxford. Oxford has a long relationship with war and a long relationship with studying war and a long relationship with engaging with the humanitarian aspects of war, going right back to the Middle Ages with the early Professor of Law, Alberico Gentile, and coming up to date more recently with someone sitting in the front row here, Sir Adam Roberts, who has worked so much over his career alongside the ICRC and in producing important works on the laws of war and other things. So it's a great pleasure to be continuing that tradition by having you here today, Eve. Thank you very much. And thinking of current things we're doing here at Oxford as well, obviously the ICRC agenda of the laws of war, humanitarian action in war, state and individual responsibility in war is a huge part of our agenda at ELAC in terms of ethics, law, and armed conflict. But increasingly, as we think of ourselves now at Pembroke College and in the home of the new Centre for Human Rights for Future Generations, there is also no doubt that violence, whether it be sort of endemic violence that we're seeing on the rise in large parts of the world, in Mexico, where Eve has just returned from, in Central America, or whether it be non-international armed conflict or international armed conflict, the rights of people in future generations will determine on how that violence is played out. So I think violence and war of all kinds will continue to be a very important agenda for the Martin Program on Human Rights and Future Generations. So even more important that you're here to help us launch that centre's new role here at Pembroke. And Eve himself, just a couple of things for you to know about Eve. I was invited to a dinner in the old town of Geneva in about the year 2000 by a lovely, very distinguished member of ICRC who said to me, Hugo, I want you to come to Geneva. I want you to come and have dinner with someone who I think is going to be rather important in the ICRC and in the future of the ICRC. So I turned up at a famous little restaurant in the old town of Geneva called the Carnivore. No vegetarianism for ICRC. And we met, and I met for the first time Eve. And quite correctly, this lady, Marion, was right. Eve has been an extremely important part of the ICRC in the last 10 years and is now leading it with President Peter Maurer, the new president. And I think if one was to describe Eve's contribution so far in a general term, he is a moderniser in the best sense, and he's been part of the determination and the real delivery of producing a modern ICRC for today's world. And that means, as I understand it, as I listen to Eve and as I watch the ICRC today and as I watch them tweet, or I'm going to, because Eve says I've got to tweet now, that really means adapting ICRC's core values, its core concerns around the changes in the modern world. And that's how I understand what Eve's great contribution is being to the ICRC, to make it as relevant in the modern world and to make it represent the realities of the modern world and the huge changes you've made in staffing and organizational culture is a part of that. So, Eve, it's a great pleasure to have you here. And also, you should usefully know that in the audience we have a new Oxford University Society, which is the Oxford University Red Cross Society, which we have formed over the last year or so. So the university also now has its own Red Cross Society. One of their immediate aims, apart to be kept informed on humanitarian matters internationally, is to train as many students as possible in first aid, so that actually the Oxford University Red Cross Society can be the primary provider of first aid services to Oxford University events, ranging from conferences to balls to sports events or whatever. So that's another thing that people like Daniel and others here are trying to achieve at the moment. But it's a great pleasure to have you with us. Eve is going to talk for about 30 minutes, maybe 35 minutes, and then he wants to, in his words, engage. So I suggest we then have a very good session for about 45 minutes, maybe more, where you ask questions. He's going to lead off with his thoughts on the implications of the Arab Spring, and then he's very keen to talk to you all about what ICRC is doing in Syria, what the challenges are, and really what's happening operationally for them. So, Eve, big welcome to Oxford. Thank you.
Good afternoon to all of you. Do you hear me well? Is it fine? Just wanted to know if you need a mic. I don't know, because I'm the first speaker. I don't know if the room is used to have anybody speaking. Yes, it seems. It's okay. No, this is your time to say it, because otherwise I can take the mic.
It's not too loud.
Okay, let's test. 5 minutes, and then if you don't hear me, make me a signal. I'll try to find a mic. I think it's important that we have the chance to hear each other. Hugo, thanks very much for your welcome. I'm very pleased to be here, and I think I really see this moment also not only of giving maybe some of the thinking at the ICRC right now, but also having your point, your view, I think. Why? Because we are in a time where we have, a lot of questions. Right? We don't have all the answers, really. It's a time where, as an organization, we know exactly where we want to go, want to be, but the way to go need to be adaptable. Unpredictability is extremely high for us too. Lot of issues. Syria is a good example, but I can talk a lot about a lot of other countries where it is right now very difficult to be able to act, to understand, and to be, I think you used the keyword, relevant. And what has changed over the last 10 years, at least that's our perception, is who measure us, who tell us that we are relevant or not, and who has an influence. I would say 10 years ago, if you would design our stakeholders, you would say clearly government would be absolutely central, and possibly armed forces, non-state armed group would be central to their perceptions of our relevance or not. They are still central today, but what has changed over the last few years is that people affected, the famous people affected, have become much more important to our own relevance than they were 10 years ago. And they are much more challenging for us than they were 10 years ago. You would say, as a humanitarian, you should always say, of course, the people that you serve, they should be at the center of your response. But the reality is that, yes, they are the center, but in fact, they don't influence that much our response. But it has changed now over the last few years, and I would like to come back on that because that's one of the big change we have been confronted with. I was proposed by Hugo to talk a little bit about the Arab Spring and the humanitarian challenge linked with it. Why? Because I think it's critical to understand what are we talking about, the Arab Spring, but this common notion. I will tell you, I don't like so much a notion, but it's fine. I would like to unpack it a little bit and try then to understand one or two or three trends that we can see in the linked with the Arab Spring. I will tell you that it won't stop at the Middle East. It's going further. And I will also lead you then, maybe tell you what it means then for humanitarian organization like the ICRC. I won't speak specifically about context. I will, of course, name context. But then afterwards, I'm very happy to take questions specifically on Syria or Mali or Afghanistan or anything else. I'll be happy to discuss that with you. So if we start with thinking about the Arab Spring, maybe the first thing I need to tell you, and you know that, the perspective of the ICRC, of the International Committee of the Red Cross, is only one perspective. You might have a lot of different other perspectives. So take it as one, right? Not at the perfect, just perspective. And our perspective is linked with one element. We are an organization who continue to be willing to be close to where it's happening. So we have not outsourced our response to local partners. It's important I'm saying that because this is a big trend in the humanitarian international arena. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but our view is we want to be able to maintain what I would call a direct access and a direct action. We do that, of course, sometimes in partnership, but it's critical for us to be close to where it's happening. So it means today in Syria, we have people in Damascus, but we have people traveling in Homs, in Idlib, in Aleppo, and it's complicated. We don't access every place, but we have that. Right? And I think it allows us, of course, to be able to understand sometimes a little bit more the dynamic, not only of the people affected, but also of the people who are trying to control them, right? And all the party of the conflict. I really insist that. So when I'm bringing some of the challenge, some of the perception and view is really based on what we understand from what is happening at the ground. Not sure we are very good at understanding what may be the big picture, but at the ground is what we are providing you. And I'll come back about the notion of direct actions and being able to be close to people, because I think it's a very important element. So if we talk about the Arab Spring so far, just two things. I'm happy about these notions. We know it, this notion now, by the way, is fading away. But let's try to remember on two things. One, the notion of spring. I think there was a lot of discussion about, and then the winter, whatever. But I think that's not the point. I think the point for me is, and I think we should agree with that, most likely we're confronted with a series of events, you know, can we put together that will last. I think we should agree that most likely we are confronted with a kind of a revolution. And that major revolution takes years, if not decades, and will take a lot of different forms depending on the context. That's one. And I'll come back on that, but we need to be ready to have a long-term change, turmoil, tensions, dynamic. And then we can look at Arab world. It is happening in the Arab world first, but I'm of the opinion that it would be wrong just to look at the Arab world. It has already affected more than the Arab world. I don't know where you put Iran, but we can discuss if in Iran in 2009 was not already kind of a signal of some of the change. You have to look at Central Asia, no doubt on that one. You have to look already in Africa, Mali and other places. And some of the elements might affect one day Europe, not for the same dynamic, but there are issues, I'll come back on that, which are affecting. So it is lasting. It will continue. It's with us for a long time. And we, as a collective, not only ICSE, we need to really understand what is at stake and what are we talking about when we talk about Arab Spring and this phenomenon. It's important. And two, it's not just Middle East. Middle East is at the center of this question, but it cannot just be on that. So if we just slightly unpacked it, if you allow me, and then I'll try to see what are some of the common trends. The first element which strikes me is, of course, it's important to have a contextual understanding. So what's happening right now in Tunisia has little to do with what is happening in Mali, right? We have different dynamic at stake, without mentioning Libya, Egypt, Syria. I mean, we see different elements, and it's extremely important that we understand that there are different elements. And I think one of the elements is also the context. If I look at Libya, for example, today, the dynamic of Libya, clanic dynamic almost of Libya, is shaping the outcome, right? As you would have in Egypt for a different type of dynamic. So in one hand, you would have some country like Egypt or Tunisia, which are fighting in a way to building or rebuilding political institution, finding the balance between army, justice, democracy, and it will take a long of time, whereas you have a lot of other countries which are just in a way going through or then trying to recover from almost what we call an internal armed conflict or almost a civil war. So, I mean, you have different situations. Just frame it like that, I think it's useful. But now, of course, what is interesting is to look at what are the trends. And there are some similarities and some trends. And I would like to come back on that because I think it will help us also to try to understand what are we facing and, of course, maybe to apply some of the trends then to other countries of the world and see, I don't know if we can make some link, but see maybe other places, maybe other Arab will be affected by that. The first one which strikes us, if you look at some of the country, is how much, and in all the country, the regime was or is removed from its own people. So we have a situation where, in a way, for different reasons, you have a regime far, or perceived so, far from the people, and at a time also where the regime was also perceived as a period of transition. Very strong regime, removed and then challenged in terms of legitimacy because they are in a period of transition, wanted to transit the power to the son or to the daughters or to whatever. Interesting, just as a first reflection, so you have a power in this country which is removed from the people, or perceived so, and in a situation of slight weakness. Okay, that's one, let's put it aside. I think more interestingly for us is a kind of a different dynamic. One is you have clearly a situation where young people, and I'm careful what we mean by young people, let's say under 50, so young people really being educated but also be in a situation where suddenly, and it's not new, having clearly in their area no real future in terms of job, being able at the same time to compare what's happening in other part of the world through internet or other places. So there is something about that, clearly. And you have, of course, a population, and I will link it that with that, where they have the ability that there is no real options and future in their country, right? You can even link it, if you look at Tunisia and Egypt, possibly also the fact that migration start to be even more difficult. So the options for young people in their country or in the region are narrowing, very clearly. And of course, at the same time, there is not really any response from the government for good reason. So I think you can really see a constraint on that. But I will link it immediately with the famous notions of new media. And you know, what I found interesting is not so much that we have new media, Twitter, whatever. I think that's interesting. That's one element. What I found much more interesting, and if there's one thing I would learn from what happened in Tunisia, in Egypt, slightly differently in Libya and Mali, is we are confronted with an uprising, same in Syria, without leader. Without leader. You don't have Nelson Mandela, Egyptian or Tunisian, who says, you know, this is the moment now, we've fought together for 30 years, let's do it. No, you don't. So you don't. You really have a no leader, of course, then after some forces are then taking over in a way. But the beginning of the uprising is really about people, young people connecting, using the new media. I'm not of the opinion that the new media were the decisive factors. They're an important factor, but not the decisive. But clearly what is interesting is you have individual willing in a way to play their role, connecting among themselves, and last but not least, I think the fear factors has changed. It means that you have people who feel that in their balance, it's useful, it's okay to connect, to go, to say, for you know, more space, more freedom, more job, versus being afraid of the government and the repression. So I think there is something around that which is interesting. So we need to capture that because, just interestingly, you know, if I look at around, I was recently in two countries, and I don't want to now specifically look at the country, but you can see clearly some of these elements which clearly can apply. So if you go in Central Asia, you can have a different opinion, but you can look at some countries, you would absolutely see young people, rather educated, a bit of distance with the government, you know, where it starts to be more difficult in terms of how much you share your space in the economy, the ability to connect also, internet. I mean, you can look into that. You can look totally different in India, and I'm not saying in India we'll have an Arab Spring, but India, what happened, for example, in Delhi, linked with the gang rape. The issue was not, instead, was just about the rape and the gang rape. The issue was that people took the floor, went on in the street, demonstrated absolutely without leader, right? Very quickly. And I think this is also, as a country, that has an enormous impact. How do you look at that? By the way, if I look at Europe, if I look at some of the things which happened in 2005 in France or in 2011 in this country, you can see the fact that also young people connecting, being able to take the street, to go on, without, you know, chain of command that we know. So I think there is something around that which is changing a bit the dynamic in which governments are looking at their people. So let's agree, we have a complex dynamic, which is in a way different country by country, and then maybe the difference by country will shape the outcome. But also let's agree that there are, I think, some trends which I think are important to look into that. Now, if I try to focus on the humanitarian challenge for the people first, and then I will look at what are the challenges for us as an organization. I think what is very worrying right now, and much more worrying today than 2 years ago, I think 2 years ago, a lot of people were, in fact, they were maybe enthusiastic about, wow, this is something positive, it's about freedom, but because we wanted to apply our own grid of reading. We said, oh, this is great, these people are now fighting for freedom. I think we totally underestimated the fact that a lot of issues were economically related. Not everything, but there was an issue about economy, about jobs, about opportunity. I mean, in Egypt, one of the key factors totally underestimated was the price of the bread going up. Right? In Tunisia, very much the same. Basic commodity is going up. And this is suddenly maybe the drop which is too much, you know? It's not the only one, but it's an important one. What is worrying is 2 years later, today, nothing has been solved in pure economic terms. For the people in all this country, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Mali is not, without even mentioning Syria, the economic situation, not only even the violence, the economic situation has got much more worse. Right? So the very same people, in a way, who fought, who went in the streets, they found themselves with a situation which has become worse. And typically, Egypt is a good example. You have a lot of discussions about constitution, and rightly so, about the role and responsibility of each other. Still, I mean, you have today much more people who have just get under the level of poverty. So it won't just go away, right, I think. And so first element to know in terms of humanitarian challenge, today you have a much larger part of the population which found today the situation is worse, especially in economic terms. So if there is one element I would like to insist is really the economic factors, which is a critical one, critical for them. And please, I think you know that, but you suddenly see that the price of the food, I'm talking really basic commodities, have gone up in 2008. Not all of them, most of them. And what is new is that they never went down since then. So we're in a situation where the price of food have gone up really very high. And at the same time, in most of this country, you have also the price of electricity and other places all have gone up. So I think I think the situation, just the economic situation for people, is complex. You can just add to make it more difficult, as you mentioned, challenge, is of course that the financial crisis and the economic crisis in general, I should say crisis with an S because I think there are several and impacting each other, means also the states, most of them, have less money and less means just to be able to deploy social response. The gap between the reality of the people, the fact that they are more poor, more under pressure, and the ability for states or, you know, even charity services to help them has grown. So I think we have a real issue around that. Can I just make also a link? And the thing, one of the point also is, of course, not only Middle East, you can see Europe. This morning, I mean, you saw that Spain is 27.4% officially of unemployment. 54% of young men and women under 27, no job. Don't think it will go through easy and people will just wait for the next 10 years when there is no options. I think we will also see pressure on governments, on society, on the Red Cross, by the way, to be able to respond to that. I'm really convinced about it. So I think when you are in Egypt or in Tunisia, and one of your options was also to be able to go, or maybe in Europe, and try to make your chance. And now these days, you find it difficult in your country, and you know that migrating to Europe is even more difficult than it was before. I think it also puts pressure on all of us. So first factor is really the economic crisis in which we are and the impact it has on the food price and the fact that nothing has been solved in all of the country regarding that. The second humanitarian challenge is the increase of the level of violence. And I was happy, Hugo, that you mentioned that before in general, but I think it's very clear. For today, in most of this country, I mean, the level of violence perceived by the people, or real, has increased. It's more difficult. Maybe not on all of them, but it is. If you look at Libya, these days nobody speaks about Libya anymore. It has disappeared almost from our radar. For Libyan people, there is enormous tensions between, in fact, the region to control the resources. It's very complicated for, you know, average people. I'm not saying before it was paradise, that's what I'm saying, but before the rules of the game were, let's say, relatively clear. Today, it's very, very tense, it's very complicated, so the level of violence is a big issue. And of course, in the midst of all that, you have Syria. In Syria, we're not talking about tensions, we're talking about a war. War with absolutely a level of violence. I must say, if I'm speaking about ISIS and my colleagues, what I'm hearing, what I've seen, is we have rarely gone through such a level of violence. And it's extremely problematic because in Syria right now you have a country which is completely affected now by the war in every part of the country. Right? I would say every Syrian, after 2 years, you would say it's normal, but every Syrian really feels the war. There is very little options. That's also not one of the, one of element, and we are back to a situation where it's the revenge dynamic kicks in, right? Where, in fact, through communities, through enormous tensions, which makes it extremely difficult. So the level of violence, and people are aware of that, because, of course, we are in a time where it's extremely easy for you. So imagine for any Jordanian, Lebanese, and people from the region, without mentioning Syria, it's very easy to download any video where you see beheading of people on a daily basis in Syria. So you have also this psychological impact on the level of violence. So you have a level of violence which is extremely high and will continue to impact on the region. The third humanitarian challenge is that in all of this country, almost all of the country, you had system, health system, economic system, education system, which were state-led, right? Or at least state-led, let's say, at least with rather centralized, most of them, with the exception of Mali, I would say. And of course, when you have a collapse of the economy, a lot of tensions or war, one big challenge we see is that systems are collapsing. And if I just give you two examples, one is, of course, Syria. If I just look at the health system, a rather good and sound health system before the war, now today what we see, and I would like to be careful with the figures, because frankly, it's extremely difficult to have a sense. But if I compare two comparisons, one, our experience in Iraq was that in 2006, during the war, doctors were targeted, really specifically. There was a moment where quite a lot of doctors were targeted. And some of them, it was due to the fact that they were in the wrong place, or was not, or because of ethnic or religious questions, but also because they were doctors. The figures, and we think the figures are serious, the figures on Iran was in a year, 1 year, Iraq lost 50% of their doctor. 17,000 doctors left in the country. One of the reasons is because they are middle class, they still have the money to be able to, you know, leave the country, and you find yourself in a situation where truly you don't have, again, in a country like that, people being able to help. In Syria, we don't have figures. But what we see today in hospitals, official hospitals, we see very junior doctors everywhere. Very junior people, right? Who are trying to do their best. Not so much a lack of medicines, it's in this case a lack of competences, under very difficult situation because the hospitals are bombed. Because for patients, this is the last place where you go because you're arrested in hospital. So I think it's a difficult place. But even on the top of that, in terms of competences, you suddenly have an entire system which is not only affected economically but also in terms of social knowledge, if you want, and competence and people living. So I would really not underestimate what's happening in terms of health in some of the country and the impact it has then, of course, on the entire society. You can say the same about education, very clearly, and this is more difficult for us. We have less experience at the International Committee of the Red Cross, but we can see clearly, again, in some of these countries, that there is less money, less ability, no salary being paid, and of course, when you are in conflict, then you just have no education system working. So we are in a time, just think quickly about Syria. Even if the war would stop tomorrow, which I hope, we are there for a long, long time in terms of just reconstructing this country. This country will need enormous effort, and who will pay for it? Will be ready to help Syria for the next 10 years just to reconstruct their city. Look at how difficult it is for Iraq. And Iraq is a rich country. Syria is not rich itself. Look at Egypt, how difficult it is to rebuild, if you want, some of the institution. So it takes a lot of time, and it makes it extremely difficult. I have two more challenges, and they are more linked with a psychological dimension. I think it's interesting because you were talking about modernization. One thing we have learned at the ICRC, and it's nothing to do with me, I think it's done our relationship with people on the ground. We've really seen over time that the physical impact is critical. So when you do humanitarian actions, you absolutely need to take care of health, of economic security. That's critical. But we understand more and more how important it is to be able to talk about mental health, take care also, and some people, this is what they need. Being able to really integrate that in our thinking. Typically, when we work inside prison, for example, most of the detainees, what they're telling us is it's not about food, it's not always, not about space, but sometimes it's about, you know, just having an understanding why I'm here since 12 years without any judgment, any request, I don't know why. So the psychological dimension is enormous. We know that all sexual violence has an enormous impact also on the psychology, as an example. So for us, our ability to understand that is absolutely critical. So what I would say is we see that across the Arab Spring country, that the psychological element is an important one. There is pressure on people, and it's linked with also unpredictability. We are in a time, I think a lot of people were used maybe to unpredictability, but unpredictability has increased. Look at our own society, how we find difficult. Things are changing quickly, the parameters are changing. It's difficult for people already to grasp what are the rules of the game. Imagine when you are right now in Mali or in Syria, how difficult it is to understand what will happen tomorrow. And what is even more striking, in no country I mentioned, there is a clear understanding of what will happen in 6 months. Nobody knows. Really, frankly, nobody knows. Nobody has a clue. You can make scenarios, but it's very difficult. So that has an impact also on all of us, but of course, especially on people and their difficulties to project themselves in the future. And I think we should really not underestimate that. And I would like to make the link with, I mentioned Spain, I mentioned Europe. For me, one of the elements in Europe which is changing is that for the first time, we have people, we have us, having in front of us 5, 10 years, we don't know, with, in a way, a message that it will be tough, but nobody knows how long it will be, how tough it will be. With a very gloomy picture, it has a collective impact on countries like Portugal, Spain, but it could have an impact also everywhere in Europe, in terms of what do you mean. So imagine when, on the top of that, your level is lower and you have violence. So it makes it extremely difficult. So if I come back to the ICRC and maybe to humanitarian organizations like that. What are the challenges? And I will finish with that. Is the first challenge for us as an organization,
frankly, when the Arab Spring started in Egypt and Tunisia, we didn't see it happening. We were taken by surprise. And that was a shock for us because we are an organization, we know what's happening. We have an understanding. Not perfectly, but we grasp it. This is the big difference between working and focusing on natural disaster. Natural disaster, you do a lot of preparedness, but of course, when it happens, you're always surprised. Always, right? And that's why the local response is so important, because that's what happens. When you work in war, in conflict, if you look at that, you might have some surprise in terms of timing, but normally you're aware, you're close, you understand, you feel it, and you have a good sense of what's happening. We didn't get it, right? We were very surprised by the level of violence, the dynamic, we found it very... We learned very quickly, so let's be honest, afterwards you catch up. And I'm not proud of it, but just to tell you, for the Mali, we saw it coming very quickly. Why? Because we are in Libya, we were in Libya day one, and we saw very quickly a lot of weapons moving out of Libya and going to Mali. That was very clear, if you know well Mali, and the very complex dynamic, that if you have a lot of weapons coming in that country, very quickly will have some consequences in the general dynamic in Mali. But still, very difficult. So I think one element for an organization like us was, okay, we need to challenge our own assumption, the way we understand what's happening. We need to be careful, understand what are the coping mechanisms. Maybe we didn't get it, the economic elements. We didn't get the little twist. So I think first challenge, really, how do we grasp what's happening? How do we make it? How do we don't just, you know, classical, put our own reading, you know, of, you know, this is Egypt, this is the way it is in Egypt. No, it's not. So how do we do that? I think it's a critical element, and be much more careful and understanding really the diversity of needs. And it's a very, and diversity of issues. And it's complex for an organization like us, because I think, of course, at the end, we need to have a response and the ability to respond to that, but we need to be able to have that. The second element linked with that is, of course, it has also changed slightly our own perspective in terms of how do we respond to the needs. And I think this is a big challenge for international humanitarian organizations. Is today, we are moving, and surprisingly enough, and there's a tension, so we have to move outside of a standard response when we do humanitarian. And it's strange because when you are normally working in emergency, you have a very standardized response to be fast, to be quick, to be able to do that. And it's very clear that if you have a diversity of needs and issues, you need yourself to be able to deploy a diversity of response or find a partner who will help you to do that. But you need to be able to do that. It's critical. If you just look at the needs of the people through the prism of health or water or children, that's one way to look into that. But you have a real risk to miss what's happening. So you need, as an organization, and it's a big challenge in terms of management, things about that, and in terms of resources and competencies, we need to have a large talent of human services that we can deploy depending on the issues. Which means in my organization, for example, today, we will have from, I hope, will recognize that, some very strong international law experts, but at the same time, some forensic persons, some psychologists, some diplomats, 152 different competencies today, very differently marked, just to be able to understand. And it's not perfect, but it's absolutely critical to be able to do that. Because the challenge is much bigger, and we've seen that. The Arab Spring was not the moment where suddenly we discovered that, but it has put us much more aware of that, if possible. The other element linked with humanitarian needs is, let's say, understanding the needs, is the ability to manage at the same time acute needs when there is a crisis. Libya is a good example. And when you intervene in Libya, you have to understand there is acute problems. Syria is a good example too. You have to be able to work on acute issues, but at the same time understand what are the chronic and more systemic issues. And you need to be able to work around that. And one of the issues is, even if the dynamic is new, in most of this country you have really chronic issues, and you cannot just intervene on small acute. So when you intervene in a hospital, or when you really want to tackle the detention issues, you need to at the same time understand some of the social dynamics, some of the systems. You need to be able to tackle that. And I think it's a big issue for us in our ability to manage that. So first challenge as an organization is, how do you really understand the needs? How are you clothed enough? And how are you able then to move out of a very classical, standardized response? And it's complicated in a world where donors, but also other people, want us to have standardized, and rightly so, I mean, up to, you know, certain level of response. The second challenge, which is, I think, maybe the biggest challenge we have right now, is access to people affected. And here, I would like to be clear with you, is direct access. If I may, myself, as ISIS, having been there, close to where it's happening. And not only one and you're off, repeated access. Repetition seems to be the key element. As an organization, we want, and I think it's critical that we grasp that, we want to be an organization which is not able only to assist people, but also try to protect people. And repetition is absolutely critical. Being there, understanding, coming back again is fundamental. And right now we are in a time where access by international humanitarian organization is not welcome. Overall. Very clear. And there is several reasons. One, there is no obligation. We are very rarely in international armed conflict. They represent about 5% of the conflict today. Today, the vast majority of conflict are internal. So there's no real obligation from the government, from the authorities, to welcome international organization. B, it's not new, but the pressure is big. There is clearly a gain, or let's say more assertiveness, for states to express their sovereignty. Even failed states, I'm careful about this notion of failed, let's say weak states, are expressing their sovereignty. You know, I'm amazed by Kenya 2007, when there was post-election violence, a very high level. I had the feeling that the only thing the two parties agreed was make sure that there is no international intervention. They disagree on everything else, but they didn't want to have an international organization intervening in their space. Look at Myanmar when there was a typhoon 4 years ago. I mean, they managed, and it was not the Myanmar of today, it was Myanmar 4 years ago, almost considered by the international community as a rogue country. They still managed to make sure that there was not an international intervention or only led by them in the regional structure. So look at Sri Lanka, look at Kenya, look at, we can look at a lot of countries. And even today, if you look at Syria, you can clearly, if you would look at the UN Humanitarian Actions Program, it's called UN Humanitarian Actions led by the Syrian government. In order. So this is the way it is, and I think it's interesting. So we have something which makes it very clear that today, international organizations find it difficult to join in. And last but not least, of course, you have security issues, which make it complex. We have not to exaggerate the security. It's difficult, but it's our job also. Sometimes at risk, not stupidly. And I don't put security as the first issue. I think we find it more difficult sometimes to get access and accepted in a world where today a lot of international organizations, and to finish on that, in their own system, they have outsourced the risk. And they have local partners as a main source of responder. So, of course, it makes it difficult when, as an organization, you're willing to really be on the spot, be close, happening. I think this is one of the problems. So, direct access, making sure that government, but also non-state armed group, understand that, that population wants that, is absolutely of critical essence. And I must say, as a working at the ICRC, is if my organization will be not able to have direct access in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Sudan, in Congo, with all the problems, I think we would clearly, quickly lose our edge and our understanding of what's happening and our ability to influence also all stakeholders. Because direct access means also we're able to speak to everybody. And I'll give you again the example of Syria. You know how difficult it is in Syria. And I must be clear with you, it's certainly one of the most frustrating operations for, I think, all of us, for ICS. I mean, it's an operation where what we can do is so far from what we should be able to do. But I just would like to tell you also that, in fact, surprisingly enough, we are able to get access, we are able to cross line, we are able to discuss. It's very painful, I'm not saying it's great, together with our colleagues of the Red Crescent. But why are we able to a little bit do a bit more now than we were able to do 6 months ago, and I hope even more tomorrow than today? It's because we are there. Because we talk directly to the governors of Homs and Aleppo, because we understand what are the non-state armed actors, and they are very difficult, it's very fragmented, but because we are there. Why are we able to talk and have a meaningful response in Afghanistan with all the problems? It's because we have not discovered the Taliban yesterday. We have talked with them, but also with the, at the same time, the government, the international forces since years, and not just once, engaging on the spot. And this is absolutely critical. If the humanitarian start to lose that, accept to lose that, that will be a major impact, especially on the protection side. So direct access is absolutely critical for us. Last but not least, it's, and I was related to that, and I think we are struggling with that, is how do we engage with multiple stakeholders. As an organization, we are used, and this is the way we do it, we are used to work with government, with army, with non-state armed group, where the chain of command is rather clear. You know how it works. How do we work in the world of today and tomorrow, where, in fact, people, group of people, without leaders, are challenging you, are asking you to do things, are comparing, are rating you, almost life. And just to give you one or two examples, which strikes me always, I think some of you are aware of that, but it's an example which really makes me think about it. The first day when we announced it, that we were able to visit the Damascus Central Prison, we were talking about 18 months ago, the very same day, some of us got SMS on our phone saying, hey, it's the wrong prison, not the right to go. Go there, you know, with a GPS. So you have people connecting with you. You don't know why they got the number. You know, bringing me to have a direct impact on you. Okay, you can say that's okay. You can manage it. Right? That's anyway. More complex is when you have people who are, in fact, sending you, for example, picture or allegation of extreme violence, or where you are directly challenged on YouTube by people saying, no, there is no help happening here. I can even not talk, let me move out of the Arab Spring for a minute. My colleagues of the American Red Cross were very challenged during Sandy recently in New York. They did a good job. That was what really was a buzz. There was a man who filmed on the, it was on the roof with water, and he was shouting, "Where is the Red Cross? I don't see them. Nobody here is to help." And it came into mainstream media, and it's very complex, and it has to influence. You have to move on. And I think it's an interesting element. IT is a good example too, where in IT, which is an example that strikes me, in IT, when the earthquake happened, a lot of resources were flown in related to Port-au-Prince and the neighborhood. And there was a family which was something like 30 kilometers out of Port-au-Prince. Sadly, the building collapsed, and one of the younger daughters was locked under the and there was nobody to help them. There was not enough people to help them. And what is interesting is they managed to have the phone numbers of an American senator send to this American senator a photo of the daughter. What is amazing is the American senators didn't destroy, but look into that. He called us. I said, the good news is my colleagues in Washington realized it was an American senator, so let's take it seriously. You never know, you know. We called CENTCOM, which is in fact what's the central command of the US forces managing, in fact, IT. They understood ICSC plus the American senators must be serious. And they gave instructions to the helicopters in IT to change their plan and to go catch this girl. The sad news is it was too late. She died. But what I found interesting, just as a learning, is today people affected can change your plan. They can put pressure. They can directly engage, which is absolutely was not the case before. They can rate you. They can compare. For us, we have a lot of experience in Darfur or the places where communities were compared. You know, people would say, you know, you're coming in my community, but you don't help, you don't do enough. I've seen that in the other community, you give more. I mean, all these kind of questions, we were used to that. Today, what is amazing is people are comparing from a country to another. They are challenging directly, they are engaging much more, and I think what I'm saying just here is it is challenging our almost intermediary role, you know? The role between you, if I took you here, and the people affected. Right? We will tell you what are their needs. You know? That was the position of humanitarian. Most likely people are now directly telling you what are their needs. So we have to think about what is our role, how do we engage, what does that mean, how do we validate that. And by the way, this challenge is not only felt by us, I think it's felt big time by the media, for different reasons. But you can look at media today, if you want to be informed about Syria, I mean, you have all the information you want. Right? Now, of course, what media can then play maybe is to be able then to put that together and to give a sense of it. But in a way, this is a big challenge for us. How do we capture that? And especially looking at, again, the Arab Spring, how do we make sure that we understand? Now, again, the Arab Spring in Libya, in Egypt, in Tunisia, we are back to what we know, which means dealing with government, with army, or with armed group. Because the people have, in a way, come back again to the position that they were 2 years ago. But how are we able to listen, to make sure that we engage, we understand, we see that?
That's a critical element. So I think, to finish and to conclude that, I think we need to be prepared for a long spring, to put it that way, or for a very long time. I think we are clearly of the opinion that what has happened now in the Middle East will continue. I must say Syria will be a pivotal element of what's happening on the Middle East. I've been well aware of that today Lebanon, Jordan are very, very close to, I would say not collapse, but to be not able anymore to take all the refugees. It's extraordinarily difficult. Lebanon, just to give you a sense, it's 25% of the population just arrived on top of it.
you are aware that part of already very important force of Lebanon are fighting already in Syria. So if you look at, of course, what might happen in Syria, it will have an impact. It has an impact in the region. It will have an impact on Iraq, on Turkey. It has already. It has an impact. It will have an impact in Palestine, Israel. So you can see that depending on what will happen, the impact of Syria will go on. But we can see also that the wave of what we've gone through is not finished. Right? And I think, again, it means for us being able to be there, to be able to have access, to understand, to be able to deal with these issues. And I think also maybe, in a sense, that's one of the reasons I'm interested to go, and so glad that you invited us to you today, is I also have the opinion that in the years to come, we won't be in a position, and Syria has shown it, to have an international convergence, I'm talking about state, to be able to deal with global issue like conflict. I don't think so. I think we are in a time where governments might be able to deal with terrorists, it's possible, but I don't think governments globally will be in a position to deal with conflict. I don't think there is an international convergence. So the key word most likely for us, especially when you talk about armed conflict, will be containment. And that's not new, but it's maybe more clear now. So I have maybe in 20 years things will be better. But let's say the next 10 years, in terms of conflictuality, in terms of tensions, in terms of connections between the different issues, we've seen how much Mali was influenced by Libya, and how much now what is happening in Mali will have an influence on Niger and possibly Nigeria. Just look at the region. Look from Mali to Somalia. It's amazing to think that the only country these days stable is Chad. For one who knows the region, it tells you a little bit about the problem and the issue. So let's be aware of that. Is no international convergence, at least allowing to deal with conflict. So containment will be the big issue. So for us, humanitarian, the ability to make sure that people don't forget, but also that we are able to get access, being there, that we get also the support, will be absolutely critical. I'm sorry to give you a bit of a gloomy picture. I wanted to give you something positive. It's a revolution, maybe, we're confronted with. Let's remember in history that revolution, most of them, all of them, ended well, but it took a long time before it ended well. Thank you.